Good morning. I'm Will Seaman, your co-host this morning for One Land, Many Voices. And this morning I'm very fortunate to have with me Hala, our regular co-host, is not here. But this morning we have Zaha Hassan. Good morning, Zaha.
Good morning.
Zaha is, of course, co-founder of Americans United for Palestinian Human Rights. She's been active on this issue for many, many years. And she's going to help us with another special guest we have. Zaha, who is it we have on the phone from Ramallah this morning?
We have Mohammed Jaradat. Mohammed is the co-founder of Badil Resource Center for Palestinian Residency and Refugee Rights. It's based in Bethlehem in the occupied West Bank. He is also a co-founder and coordinator for the Global Right of Return Coalition. Mohammed is also a former political prisoner in Israeli prisons. Welcome, Mohammed.
Thank you, Zaha, and everybody.
Mohammed, just to start off, we'd like you to tell our listeners about the work of Badil and how it was established, and a little bit about the global situation of Palestinian refugees and internally displaced persons.
Badil Resource Center for Palestinian Residency and Refugee Rights has been established officially in January 1998. But practically, it's been acting as committees on the ground with the grassroots since after Oslo declaration, where we Palestinians felt very much that the hard core of the Palestinian issue is not very well tackled or even very ridiculously mentioned in the Oslo Accord to postpone the refugee question to the final status negotiations. As Palestinians, we know very well the Israeli Zionist mentality on negotiations and what will come up with the final status negotiation, if it happened at all. Therefore, we started organizing on the community level in Palestine and in the exile communities since 1994, where we had several popular conferences took place in the occupied territory, 67, inside Israel, Palestinians who are internally displaced, and in the Arab host countries, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan. As a result of this popular organizing, Badil were emerged as a coordination and facilitator organization to the Palestinian Refugee Initiative. Practically, it started as a campaign to defend the Palestinian refugee rights, and practically also to give and to empower the grassroots and the refugees themselves from within the camp community and outside the camp community to defend themselves and to raise their voice high in front of the Palestinian leadership and the international community. This is where Badil, or how Badil has emerged. Badil in particular is an Arabic word. It means alternative. And we base our rights as enshrined in the international rights and human rights conventions, humanitarian law and Geneva convention, also as part of the 1951 refugee convention. Why Palestinian refugees and why we started at Badil this whole campaign? Is it something that we thought luxurious or something can be done easily? No, practically when we speak about the Palestinian refugees, we are speaking about the root causes of the problem here between the Palestinians and the Israelis. The Palestinian refugees are two-thirds of the Palestinian people. In the course of the 1948 war, 800,000 Palestinians were uprooted, dispossessed, evicted and removed from their normal living hoods, from their towns, from their shops, from their workshops, from their normal lovely place, day-to-day life has been uprooted. So for us Palestinians, the refugee question doesn't mean only a physical eviction. It means for us absolutely an eviction and destruction of a whole nation and civilized nation which was emerging at the time. We are speaking here not only on the issues of territorial, you know, or land grab here or there. We are speaking practically about people's rights, individual rights, whether these people will enjoy their rights, whether these people will be repaired, will be their rights repaired, their dignity will be repaired, and the oppression they have been subject to since about 60 years right now, or these people will be dealt with as a machine that they can be harassed, oppressed, and put under pressure all the time to give up one issue behind the other. These people have to feel their dignity, and they have to be given the right to choose. Practically, when you are speaking about the political frame for the solution here, it's found in the 194 resolution, which is issued by the United Nations General Assembly in December 10, 1948, where it says in its one of the paragraph 11, refugees who wish to return to their homes and properties should be permitted to do so so as soon as possible. For us, the word wish means it's part of the international law. It's part of the people's rights, you know. Wish is a free choice. People have to be given, refugees have to be given one option of three options, or one choice of three major choices. The first one, return to home and be settled and compensated. Second, to stay in the host country. And third, to choose a third country for resettlement. The first one, which is the right to return to the original home, which is Israel right now, is the only right, and the other two choices is a privilege, not right, because the host country or a third country can will say we do not want to have refugees, or refugees do not have to stay in our home. So this is what is the frame. People have to choose. As we are against forced displacement, we are against forced return also. So once the refugees make their free choice in will information and give them the right to decide by themselves, then the issue of the refugees will be solved, the conflict here in the region will be solved, and nobody will have an anger.
Mohammed, I once discussed the right of return with an Israeli political scientist who had done important research showing how the Israeli judicial system had facilitated the dispossession of Palestinian refugees and Palestinian citizens of Israel. I asked him whether, in light of his research, he supported the Palestinian right to return. He said no, even though he recognized the historical injustice that was perpetrated against Palestinians by the Zionists and the State of Israel. I asked him why, and he responded that to permit Palestinian return would only result in more conflict and violence between Palestinians and Jews, and that in any case it wasn't feasible. Does Badil really believe that Palestinian refugee return is feasible and possible?
This is for sure, 100%, the Palestinian refugee return is the practical issue in this conflict, because they are, in fact, people. You know, we are not speaking about territories, solid issue. We are speaking about people who are growing, who are educated, who are demanding their rights, and they have to be repaired. You know, their rights have to be repaired restored. All this, for me as a Palestinian, you know, when I look to the conflict, it's amazing for me when people say this issue is impractical or not practical. It's the most practical from one sense, you know, with who you make peace. With the ground, with the trees, with the stones, or with the people, with who you want to build a society and coexistence, with who you want to talk. You have to talk to the people. And if you are not talking to the Palestinian people, who actually are two-thirds of them refugees, as mentioned before, then you cannot build peace. So the engine for peace and the dynamics for peace and the prosperity in this region are practically the Palestinian refugees. This is one thing. The other thing, you know, there can be peace deals or what they call inverted commas peace in the region. It can be a cold one, and there is an, in the history of this region, there are two peace agreements done with Arab regimes. The Camp David with the Egyptian regime, since 1978, they have been in absolute agreement, the government of Israel and the government of Egypt. But do they have peace really between the two people? This is the main question. They have a peace agreement with the Jordanians in the mid-90s. Do they have a peace with the Jordanian public or population or people? It's just for media communication or PR purposes. This is for me what I say, that peace should be emerging from within the people, and people have to be convinced. This is the pillar, the foundation for any peace process, that people should be part of it, people should agree on it, and people should be, you know, the promoters of it. It cannot be from the upper, you know, part of the leadership, which is under pressure to dilute or to maximum exploit the people's rights. So this is one of the issues. The second part, you know, when people say that the right of return is not practical, that there is no space in Israel to return the Palestinian refugees. Let's say this is really not a valid argument. As we have been reading and analyzing the Israeli demographic data from the Absorption Ministry, from the Housing Ministry and the Interior Ministry, and the Israeli Statistical Bureau, 84 to 85% of the Israeli Jews living in Israel are living on 16% of Israeli proper. So practically 84% of the land, of the ground, is vacant. And this is very easy to see. Even you can Google it, and you see it on the Google. Or if you visit Palestine and Israel, you can see it by your eye. A highly populated area is a triangle between Tel Aviv, Jaffa, Jerusalem, and the rest is really vacant. And you can hear all the time, even President Bush has mentioned the development of the Negev and the Galilee. And they have been pushing and pumping in financial assets, you know, in the Galilee to Judaize it, and it didn't happen since 70 years, not only 60 years. So there is a possibility for people, Palestinian refugees, to return to the place without damaging or destroying the demographic data. The second point, you know, if really Israel have been willing and wishing to establish coexistence and peace with the Palestinians, its thorough neighbors, they would have offered the Palestinian refugees the right to choose whether to return or not to return. Israel between 1989 and 1992 has absorbed 1.3 million Russian and former socialist countries immigrants to Israel. These people, at that time, if the Palestinians were given the right, you know, choice to choose, might we have been, since the mid-90s, solved this conflict. So how come that the Israelis are looking for more immigrants to Israel and promoting and subsidizing it and pushing money into it through their media and their all their efforts to bring immigrants, and Palestinians cannot come back?
This is the other issue.
The third part of it, you know, for me, it's when they say it's the promised land, you know, it's their God who promised them with that land, but also the Palestinians have a God. which God they have to believe, you know. For me, leave this option of God, you know. We respect God for everybody. It's a personal issue, and everybody should relate to their God as the way they want, and there is no land promised to this one or that one. The land should be for the people who are living on it to enjoy it and to live in it. The fourth argument, you know, when they say we want a Jewish state and a non-Jewish state, you know, and let us take it from a very simplest way and historical point of view. If there have been, and I'm sure there have been, Jewish history or Judaism history and heritage, Romans, connection, it's in West Bank. It's in Hebron, Bethlehem, Ramallah, Nablus, and Jerusalem East. So how come they want to have a Palestinian state in the Jewish heritage and a Jewish state on non-Jewish heritage? So this is all, for me, is a political manipulation of the Zionist colonial power in the region as a racist power that it didn't want to have any kind of reconciliation with the Palestinians, but it's based on, you know, power game, where you can see the major, you know, media outlets can promote all this, that the right of return is not practical, they want a Jewish state, they want to have all this, and this is all arguments that cannot be really found on the ground. Let's say that if the Israelis really want to have to live, and as well Palestinians, to live in normal life and lead our prosperity, Israel has to get rid of its power game and get rid of its apartheid-like mentality and regime, and stick to universal values and human being respect, and we can live together, and we have no problem in that level, you know.
And I need to remind our listeners that they're tuned to KBOO Community Radio. They're listening to One Land, Many Voices, where we have, very fortunate for us, we have a very special guest, Mohammed Jadadat, co-founder of Badil, the Resource Center for Palestinian Residency and Refugee Rights. He's speaking with us from Ramallah live. We'd like to invite you to call in with your questions. If you have questions about the right of return, if you have questions for our guest, Mohammed Jadadat, co-founder of Badil, please give us a call at 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187. We're only going to be running up to the hour, 10 a.m. this morning, but we'd really enjoy hearing from our listeners this morning. Our guest again, Mohammed Jadadat. Zaha, you had another question for our guest.
Mohammed, Badil writes on its website that 2007-2008 marks a historic opportunity for faith-based organizations, individuals, community groups, the solidarity movement, unions, and political parties to pool resources and activities and campaign for a rights-based solution and an end to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Why does 2007-2008 present a historic opportunity, and why is resolution of the Palestinian refugee issue so important to the end of the conflict? And what does Badil mean by a rights-based solution?
Well, 2007 is the 40 years of occupation of the rest of Palestine, which is famous 1967 occupied territories. 2008 is marking the 60 years of the ongoing disaster of the Palestinians, what we call in Arabic Nakba. It's the disaster. Now, just for a historical counter, Israel in 1948, May 15, has conquered and occupied 78% of the historic Palestine region and built its state on it and left 22%, which laid under the two regimes. Bank fall under the administration of the Jordanian government, and Gaza fall under the Egyptian administration. Now, practically, when they say occupied territories, they don't mean all Palestine. They mean the 67 occupied territories, which is 22% of the home of the Palestinians and 78%, which is known as Israel right now. For us Palestinians, the repair and the injustice has happened, as I said before, on the Nakba in 1948, where two-thirds of our people has been uprooted, and the international law has been depowerized by the superpowers and still is not made the justice to the Palestinians. Also, in other cases, in several places, it has been done and it has been worked as well. Just remember, in the Dayton Agreement on the Balkan area is perfectly the text of the Resolution 194, which I mentioned earlier. In there, people in the Balkan has been restituted, has been returning to their homes and given the free choice to return. This is one part. The second part, you know, it's a very human issue. Those Palestinians who were evicted from their homes and properties in May 1948, when they were one day old, just born at that day, now they are 60 years old. And these people, they should be hearing a good word from the international community. Basically, we are not looking for the official decision makers. We are looking for the solidarity organizations who should be part of the justice to the Palestinians. The call is for each individual also to give solidarity to the people who have been harassed over the last 60 years. It's a kind of call for the conscious, you know, of the people, and to stop looking to the Palestinians through what's good for Israel must be good for the Palestinians. Practically, I would ask, this is a year for justice, and what's good for Palestinians also should be good for the Israelis, and Israeli, what's good for the Israelis should be good for the Palestinians if we look to the issue from a justice, you know, view, without making one side better than the other. At the same time, you know, to give the reparation for the rights. These are people who have been living in camps, and they have been living in a disastrous situation. And I just give you examples where maybe it will help to understand this problematic situation and why we call. Since 1948, Palestinians have never felt secure and have never lived secure also. Between 1948 and 1967, there were ongoing displacements, you know, by different reasons, by the Israelis, by everybody, until 1967 there were another wave of refugees and internally displaced, which we estimate right now about 1 million Palestinians. In 1982, the Israelis have came into the invasion to Lebanon and displaced the Palestinians from Lebanon. There were about 150,000 Palestinians removed from Lebanon or ran away from Lebanon. In 1990-91, the first Gulf War, also, the Gulf states have kicked 300,000 Palestinians out of their refuge places where they have been working and developing these countries. In 2003-2004, up to date, the Palestinians in Iraq, about 50,000 Palestinians have been slaughtered all the time, and I think you have been reading or hearing in the media about the Palestinians. They have been killed based on their identity as Palestinians. In Lebanon, in Nahr el-Bared, we have nothing to do with this fanatics, but also the Palestinian people who are living there as refugees in the refugee camp had to pay the heavy price on their lives, and all the casualties is among them. So imagine these people have been living for around 60 years now, and nobody is trying to move their question forward, but trying all the time to tell them, give up your right. I cannot imagine, you know, a Palestinian or anybody in the world who has been taken away from his normal livelihood, from his normal, you know, life, that they will give up their right. You know? Once you give them the choice, they have to give up their right or not to give up their right. This is a matter of individual choice.
Mr. Jadadat, we have a couple of callers. I wonder if we could go to one of our questions from a listener here.
Please.
Caller one, do you have a question for Mr. Jadadat?
No, as a matter of fact, I don't really have a question for him. He has my respect, and I believe in every human being's right to dignity and for a nice, safe place to live. I would like to clear up a couple of facts, because there's a couple of things that are kind of troubling me nowadays.
Okay, if you could be brief, thank you.
Well, I will try to be as brief as possible. You know, in 1967, when those people who were living in, you know, the quote-unquote occupied territories were taken out of there, it wasn't Israel who started it. It was actually five armies, or I don't know, it was many countries were going against Israel to destroy it, and you know, Israel fought back and won, and the entire Egyptian army was destroyed. I don't like to hear about human suffering. It's terrible. As someone who's an American citizen and getting ready to move to Israel, I just want to assure this individual that I will do whatever I can monetarily and politically to help him so that he can feel safe. But it's not going to be in Israel. Thank you.
Thank you, caller. Mr. Jadadat, would you like to respond to that caller's points about the 67 war? Mr. Jadadat, we might have lost our guest. I'd actually like to respond to that caller, and I think Zaha might have something to say about it too. My understanding of the history of the Six-Day War is that, in fact, it was Israel that struck first with an attack on her Arab neighbors, a devastating attack that indeed did destroy the Egyptian air force on the ground and devastated the Egyptian armed forces and killed many thousands of Egyptians. But this was a war that many Israeli historians are questioning whether or not that war was actually necessary. But what is indisputable is the fact that it was not the Arab neighbors that attacked in 67. It was Israel that attacked. Zaha, what is your recollection of that?
No, that's absolutely correct. And I think the caller is confusing two different Arab-Israeli wars, the 1948 war, which involved five different Arab armies, and the 1967 war. Do we have our guest back?
Mr. Jadadat, are you on the phone yet?
Hello?
Yes.
Hello, you're back.
Hello?
Did you hear our guest, our listeners?
Hello?
Hello. We may be having a few technical problems. Please bear with us. I'll take this opportunity to tell our listeners that they're tuned to One Land, Many Voices.
Hello.
And, of
Hello.
Course, you're listening to Community Radio KBOO, 90.7 FM in Portland, 100.7 FM in Corvallis, 91.9 FM in the Columbia Gorge, and naturally also available as streaming audio on KBOO's website at www.kboo.org. Our guest this morning is Mohammed Jadadat, co-founder of Badil, the Resource Center for Palestinian Residency and Refugee Rights. If you'd like to find out more about Badil, they have an excellent website at www.badil.org. That's www.badil.org. And there is a wonderful English language magazine online called Al Majdal. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
That's right.
Which has some really very interesting and very provocative and very informative articles. For example, I just want to read some of these. We've talked a little bit about the 4060 call to action. There's a commentary about the current internecine struggle, the conflict between Fatah and Hamas, an article by Ingrid Jadadat, also co-founder of Badil, The End of National Unity of the Palestinian Elites, But What About the People? Really a very interesting analysis of what's going on there. I wonder if is our guest back on the line? Not quite yet. Zaha, you have worked with Badil over in recent years. What kind of work have you been involved in?
I've worked with Badil with their legal support network. It's a network of dozens of lawyers across the globe that provide legal support to Badil in various projects that it undertakes. The work that I did was before UN treaty bodies, including the UN Committee on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination. I represented Badil in Geneva before that body in relation to Israeli practices both inside the West Bank and Gaza and inside of Israel proper.
What were some of those practices that you were bringing before the...
Some of the land policies of Israel that have served to dispossess Palestinians inside of Israel, and the same policies that are in effect in the West Bank and Gaza that continue to dispossess Palestinians there. One of the findings and recommendations of the Committee on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination was that they had expressed deep concern for the fact that they felt that Israeli practices inside of Israel may constitute racial discrimination as it's understood in the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination. In that same convention, is they define apartheid as well. So it's the closest statement we've had from the treaty body that concerns apartheid talking about Israel in this context. So it was quite significant.
And this is something I think that it looks like we do have our guest back. Mr. Jadadat, did you get a chance to hear the comment from our listener caller?
I heard half of it, but not the second part, as there was technical problem. The phone line was cut. Can you please re-summarize it for me?
Well, I would say that basically the caller was suggesting, and he may have simply confused the 67 Six-Day War and the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza and the Golan Heights with the 48 War of Independence, the catastrophe from the Palestinian people's point of view. But he was arguing that Israel was attacked and then defeated her attackers and took over the West Bank and Gaza. But I wonder if you could talk... I'm sorry.
Hello?
Can you hear us?
Hello?
Okay?
I think there is a kind of machine which makes it impossible to hear well sometimes. But as I just said quickly, he's confused between the war of 1948 and the 67. Is that right?
Yes, I mean, he was suggesting that Israel was attacked in 1967.
Absolutely wrong, you know. Absolutely, Israel has initiated the war in 1967, and this is no secret, you know. You just have to read the archives of the Israeli army and Israeli intelligence, and this is public in Israel, you know. And from his accent, I felt that he might be a Jewish fellow who has access to this issue. So it's a fact that Israel in 1967 has launched the war on Egypt and destroyed the Egyptian, you know, and surprised the Egyptian aircraft and the Egyptian facilities. And this is not an argument, Yanni. I wish him to read it. It's very simple.
Well, shall we try for another listener caller? Caller, go ahead with your question.
Hello?
For our guest.
Hello?
Hello.
Yes, hello. So yes. I don't know whether I'm being selfish to speak this, but I understand our government is maybe for some time been sending millions of dollars every day over to Israel, and I feel rotten about this. And I just see at this point in my life that we, the citizens of this country, whether we tell them, tell our government, that they stop giving this money to Israel is useless to use, to be intellectual with our government or, to use words. I'm at the point and, I'm feeling that we the citizens, to stop this money going to Israel, we have to be physical with our government, but I guess we are not equipped to do that, and I don't know how much.
Caller, do you have a question?
Anyway, okay, I just will listen, sir. Thank you, sir. Goodbye.
Thank you. I think we have a second caller. Caller, do you have a question for our guest?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Will, thank you for this show. I have a kind of a two-part question, and one part may not be ultimately relevant to the right of return, in which I think I really do believe, certainly when it comes to the older folks, if someone is 60 or over today, I'm wondering, parenthetically, whether Israel should build nursing homes for these folks. But that's neither here nor there. The question is two-part, in that 242 comes to mind, United Nations Resolution 242. How does that fit into this? And I know that that has to do with preserving pre-67 borders, but, and also, where is King Abdullah in all of this, and how can he actually play a role, besides the fact that he's fighting Islamists at home and Iraqi refugees, not fighting, but dealing with Iraqi refugees in his nation? How can King Abdullah actually, help all of this, to play a role in the resolution of all of this? And thank you for allowing me to take ask my question, and I'll take my answer off here. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, caller. Mr. Jaradat, did you hear that question?
Yes, it's the voice for law, but I think, you know, all the UN resolutions, including 242, have been calling for the refugee rights to be set on the agenda. And there is a myth and a myth here when they say that 242 or 338 or 3237, which was in 1974, doesn't. You know, in 1974, the UN Treaty for the Palestinian Unalienable Rights were built. And practically, it spoke about the right of return for the Palestinian refugees to their original home. And original home is in Israel. And this has to be, you know, clear for everybody. The home of the Palestinian refugees is not the 67 territories. It's inside Israel. Now, also the 242 is built on the Arab resolutions. It's not separate from the Arabs. We cannot read each UN resolution as a separate entity or a separate title of resolution. It's been built up from the historic responsibility of the international community as part of the United Nations since 1947, since the resolution 181 was partitioned Palestine. Up to date, all the resolutions are integrated and they are building Palestinian rights. So the heart of these rights is the Palestinian refugee rights. This is the question, and it depends how each one wants to read it. The only right reading is to read all of them together as a consecutive, you know, for the rights.
Mohammed?
And if I may comment on the... Sorry, yeah?
Sure, go ahead, go ahead.
Please. I would like to just comment on the one before. I would just thank her for her nice interpretation. The American taxpayer is being paying Israel to stay as a power, is not paying Israel from the taxes of the people of the America to build a human nation. Every American good citizen is paying for Israel every day, you know, from their own money to bring airplanes, aircraft, and heavy artillery. The most modern arsenal in the region is an Israeli one by the taxpayers. In a simple calculation, I'm not going into further details, every morning the American people are paying for Israel $23 million. I would say, as a human being, isn't it better to invest it into the American health system for the homeless and for the poor people in the United States? Isn't it better to invest it in the education system in that regard and not to give it to buy bullets and gas, you know, bombs to throw on the Palestinian children and pupils going to the school? The American citizens should think once forever that if their taxes are not used for the good of the human being, should protect and should raise their voice. They shouldn't be taking hostages to their government. I think this is a very important issue.
But
I would.
Of University of California Hastings College of Law say that regardless of whether Israel is considered the worst of the human rights abusing countries, boycott is justified by civil society in the U.S. because of the U.S. government's complicity in the violations of Palestinian human rights. How important do you think a boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign in the U.S. is for the success of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign globally?
Well, thank you. I was coming to it as part of the session. I think, you know, for us, the BDS campaign is, the human consciousness, you know. If you are really with justice, with people's rights, with equality and universal values, you should think how to find a tool to fight injustice and to fight, the brutality and cruelty of the occupation and the apartheid Zionist mentality. The BDS is three phases or three parts. Boycott is a part of the individual's consciousness and group consciousness, you know, public consciousness, solidarity consciousness. And this is a tool. Hello?
Yes.
Do you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Hello? Yeah, boycott is part of the solidarity consciousness also. And it's based on universal values. It's on people's beliefs. If you believe in justice, you have to believe that people have to enjoy their rights. And if you want to help these people, this is a good tool. It's a part of, you know, a technique and tool for the people to use where they can make their voice clear and effective. And without this, it's difficult, you know. This demonstration and mass demonstration has been in the streets in the time against the war on Iraq. But I think the politicians have developed a thin not to listen to the public in this way. But once you are trying to touch sensitive issue like boycotting Israel, which is, you know, for the politicians, a holy cow cannot be touched, then they will think, you know, and this is an important tool. The South African regime hasn't fallen only by the resistance movement inside of South Africa, but also it was an important tool. And important, you know, moral support given by the international solidarity. And I think the Americans, I believe the American public is one of the most important in this regard to take action. You know, I would just raise some questions for the people. How teachers' unions would cooperate with Israeli teacher unions when they are sitting comfortably in their schools and classrooms while their counterparts, the Palestinian teachers and pupils, can reach their, school or have to run through 24 hours military checkpoints and humiliated and being stopped. Why they cannot raise the question, can't you stop this identification checkpoints, military checkpoints? Can't you do something? I don't understand, for example, and this is for the engineers, I would raise a question. How engineers who have ethical, you know, commitment and moral commitment to human beings, will save and will be, can cooperate with an Israeli engineer's association while the engineers in Israel, they are leading the construction of the apartheid wall. They are leading the Israeli battles to destroy Palestinian houses and public infrastructure. Is this not an issue to be raised?
Mr. Jadadat, we have another caller. with another question for you.
You know, tech is, then I think the Israeli different organizations, associations, civil organizations would start to feel that they are not welcomed, they are not doing something against the injustice and the inhumanity done to a whole nation. On the issue of divestment, I think there are the first optimism came from state-based organizations from the United States, and we really appreciate that. They were the first ones to grab it, and we would like to have it, to see it wider than this. There are companies who are investing in Israeli companies who does immoralities. You know, business has to have phases of, you know, human respect and moral respect for their business. It's not only accumulating capital, it's also accumulating ethical issues. So we sincerely demand from these, you know, companies, either business or non-governmental organizations who have investments in Israel to divest it, even selectively, for a good reason, that these investments shouldn't be on the expense of a whole nation under occupation, a whole nation looking for reparation, you know, looking for justice.
And I want to remind our listeners that they're tuned to One Land, Many Voices. I'm Will Seaman, and with me in the studio is Zaha Hassan. We're speaking with Mohammed Jadadat, co-founder of Badil, the Resource Center for Palestinian Residency and Refugee Rights. We just have barely 5 more minutes in this morning's program. I want to remind folks that they can find out more about Badil by going to their website at www.badil.org. That's BADIL.org. I also want to mention that the music that you heard at the beginning of the hour and that you're going to hear after we close out today's show is by Marcel Khalife, who is going to be playing at the Aladdin Theater on Sunday, October 28th. That's Marcel Khalife, UNESCO Artist for Peace, who's coming to Portland in October, October 28th. And that, I think, is a concert that no one will want to miss. We have time, I think, for one caller. Caller, what do you have a question for Mr. Jadadat?
I think the what we should all recognize is that the problem for the Palestinians as well as Americans is that Jewish Americans haven't the courage to confront AIPAC, the so-called American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, which virtually controls the foreign policy of the United States. We occupied Iraq for Israel. It was arranged by the so-called neoconservatives, which is just another name for rabid Jewish American Zionists, and the entire story is in Jim Bamford's A Pretext for War.
Do you have a question for our guest caller, Mr. Jadadat?
I just want to say that congratulations that for what he's trying to do, but the real problem exists here in America with the power of AIPAC. Jewish Americans don't have the courage to confront AIPAC, and that goes for senators like Ron Wyden, various other senators. The problem is here in the United States.
Thank you, caller.
And thank you, KBRU, for having us on the air, but we need more programs like this.
Well, we're working on it. Thank you, caller. Mr. Jadadat, do you want to comment on the caller's point about the formulation of U.S. foreign policy with respect to Israel and the Palestinian struggle?
Quickly, just to say, you know, if the people do not move on the ground and do something real, the American administration will not change and will bring more disaster to its own people, you know. And this is an unpopular act of the United States to favor one side over the other, and the justice is clear where is it, you know. And this is what I would say, that the new Neue Conservatives on the government of the America has destroyed a lot of human achievements, you know, and ethical achievements, moral achievements, and you should fight this hard and build it back and get in your feet. That's what I would say, and thank you.
Mohammed, I just have one question in closing to ask you. Do you believe that the two-state solution is, in fact, unworkable and that Palestinians should be working now, given the anti-apartheid framework that has been developed globally in discussing the Palestine-Israel conflict? Do you think a Palestinian should be calling for a one secular democratic state that would encompass the occupied Palestinian territories today and Israel proper?
You know, Israel practically has not left a room for the two-state solution. Just to give a quick, you know, because the time is passing, Israel since September 13, 1993, which is the day of the signing of the declaration in Washington, of Oslo Declaration, there were 180,000 settlers in the occupied territory 67. Between that date up to December 2006, there are 475,000 settlers, about a half million settlers. So Israel has worked all its, you know, power to demonize and to destroy any possibility for a Palestinian state to emerge. Therefore, the only human solution and practical solution for the future to come is a one democratic secular state for all its people. One man, one vote. This will give the Palestinians the right to return. This will give the Israelis the right to say that we are here and we are part of this region. Other than this, I don't think that the two-state solution based on the Bush vision, which they have been trying to push it in the region, is no more than a morphemic solution, and it will not work. Just watch what this what's going on the ground. And for me, the one democratic state is answering most of the questions that politicians never think about. For me, the Palestine is Palestine, and Israel is part of it, and it's solving human beings, you know, rights. Maybe I don't want to go to Ramallah, but I want to go to a weekend on the Mediterranean beach where I can have my weekend. Why I should travel 5 hours somewhere outside to be able to have my vacation while I have the most beautiful beaches? Why a Palestinian need a visa to both visit his ancestors and grandparents, you know, graveyard in Jaffa or Haifa? Why an Israeli worshipper should seek, what you call it, a visa or a permit to go to pray in the Machiavelli or the Abraham Mosque? This is all, you know, what they are trying to build or separate is non-acceptable for human beings. You know, we are human beings. We are not solid items. As a human being, I want to feel that my rights in this state is guaranteed. I can move. I can live in Tel Aviv. They can live in Hebron. I can move. They can move. And we can live normal like a human being. This is basic right. This mentality of separators has been working within the region since the early 20th century.
Mohammed Jadadat,
we're
at the end of our hour, I'm afraid.
Sorry?
We're at the end of our hour, I'm afraid. We've been speaking with Mohammed Jadadat, co-founder of Badil, the Resource Center for Palestinian Residency and Refugee Rights. Mohammed Jadadat, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much for your invitation. Thank you.
And I want to thank our listeners and my co-host, Zaha. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Hala will be back next month. Again, that's the fourth Friday of each month at 9 a.m. here on KBOO Community Radio for One Land, Many Voices. If you'd like to send us some feedback, any kind of feedback, critical feedback, positive feedback, write to us at pdxjustice@riseup.net. That's pdxjustice@riseup.net. We'd love to hear from you. We're going to be closing now with that music from Marcel Khalife, who's going to be here on Sunday, October 28th. He's a wonderful classical oud player. That's a concert that you will not want to miss at the Aladdin Theater on Sunday, October 28th, Marcel Calife. And now we're going to go to that closing music, I believe. It's not quite queued up yet. We're going to go to the closing music now. Thank you for tuning in.
الدنيا شا يمشي على خدمه